Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I hear you. Seems like you're saying something like this is right and those are wrong. But I don't think that's what you're saying. I don't think that's
yeah.
what you're saying.
Yeah, I'm not. I wasn't saying, you know, that the Buddhist path is the only path and the other ones are wrong. Because from a Buddhist point of view, you know, there is some of the gradual path to enlightenment in every religion. Because you'll see certain common elements in all religions. And so whatever elements there are in other religions that lead to enlightenment, if they're practiced at some level of the path, then these things are to be respected and practiced. So for example, you know, Hinduism talks about reincarnation. So that's very helpful. Now the Buddhist view of reincarnation is slightly different than the Hindu view, but still there's certain elements of the Hindu view that are really compatible, and that if we learn them, it can help us understand the Buddhist view of reincarnation. Similarly, certain teachings in Christianity, Jesus' whole thing about turn the other cheek and forgiveness and patience, you know, we would say these are Buddhist teachings. Yeah, it may come out of Jesus' mouth, but it doesn't mean that because it comes out of somebody's mouth, it belongs to them. Okay, these are universal teachings. They also fit in with the Buddhist path. If you look in Islam or Judaism, I'm sure you'd find certain ethical principles, too, that very much apply to the Buddhist path. So we would say those are also Buddhist teachings. Now, I don't know how much other religions would like us to tell them that they practice parts of Buddhist teachings. You know? But the label Buddhist teachings is a very general one. You know, it doesn't mean whatever Buddha said. Yeah, it's whatever, if you practice, leads you on the path. Yeah? And so for that reason, all these different elements in different religions are to be respected and practiced. Now, if a religion teaches something that doesn't lead to ultimate happiness, you know, for example, if a religion says it's okay to kill animals, go ahead, you know, well, that part of it isn't Buddhist teachings, and that part we shouldn't practice. Yeah? Or if some religion says, you know, to be sectarian, then that part we don't practice. If some, you know, all these, we have to have a lot of discriminating wisdom, okay? Because other traditions have a lot of good things that we should adopt, but then there are maybe some faulty things that we should just leave alone. Is that making sense?
Yeah.
Does that answer your question?
That's what I thought.
Okay. Well, the Tibetans teach it very much in a level way. In other words, the Tibetans teach it that if you practice the Theravada tradition, you can attain arhatship, but just based on those teachings, you can't attain fully enlightened Buddhahood because it doesn't have, you know, the deeper interpretation of emptiness, for example. Yeah? And then they would say that, for example, the general Mahayana, you know, that's very good, that will lead you up to the 10th level of the Bodhisattva path, but to become a fully enlightened Buddha, you need to enter the Vajrayana. So the Tibetans place it in that systematic way. Okay? However, I think still, that doesn't mean that one teaching is really lower than the other, and that if you practice one tradition, you're inferior. Because if we look, let's say, at the arhats, I remember one of my teachers saying, you know, you should never put down Theravada arhats because they have many more good qualities than you do. I mean, if you look at it and face it, you know, many of the people in that tradition who practiced that path and got the results have many more good qualities than, you know, than me. So something to respect, something to learn from. Yeah? And similar with the general Mahayana path. Yeah, because also I think when it gets into real practice, yeah, you can't say that because somebody is, let's say, they wear the saffron robes of Thailand or Burma, we can't say that they're not a Buddha. Okay? Because we don't know what that person's realizations are. they might have the complete Madhyamika understanding of emptiness. Yeah? They might be a bodhisattva who's manifesting as that. They might be actually, in fact, a high tantric practitioner manifesting as a Theravada teacher. So, you know, how can we say? We don't know. Make sense? Okay. Yeah. So your question is how I view the current Western interpretation of Christ? Yeah, right. In other words, you know, Jesus' followers were very pure practitioners. It got mixed in with our culture, and then we started killing people in the name of Christ. Yeah. And we burn crosses and people's wands and all sorts of things. Yeah. Yeah, this is, I mean, we always say that the problem is never really with the pure teachings of the religion. The problem is with the mistaken notions of the people who call themselves practitioners. Yeah, that's where the problems come in. Because the people who practice the religion might not be so pure. And so it gets all mixed in with greed, power, and so on. So the real, is that a danger in Buddhism coming to the West? I think it is. Okay, why? Because we're sentient beings and our minds are completely full of pride, attachment, ignorance, jealousy, all these things, yeah? So as long as our minds are deluded, our minds become a danger to the pure lineage of the teachings. So I think that it's really our own individual responsibility, if we really respect Buddhist teachings, to try and understand them deeply and practice them from the depth of our heart so that there's a transformative effect on our mind. And if there is that transformation, then our minds won't pollute the teachings. We won't misuse them. But it's up to us individually to practice very well to avoid that happening. And that's where I think the whole idea of lineage is really important. And we'll get into the subject as time goes on of the importance of having a teacher. And that's why this is really important, so that we don't go on our own trips, so that we don't take Buddhism and turn it into part of pop culture and make up our own Buddhist tradition that fits our delusions, so that we can have samsara and pretend we're practicing for nirvana at the same time. You know, this is really why it's important to have a close relationship with a teacher, so that we get a continuous input of accurate teachings, and so that we can receive, you know, our teacher can correct us if we start messing up. Yeah, I think that's one thing. Yeah, and then I mean, it has to do with sociology and political structure and all sorts of things too. Yeah, I mean, it's really difficult when a religion gets institutionalized. Because in one way, institutionalizing something protects the core of the teachings from everybody doing their own trip. On the other hand, once you establish an institution, you become protective. And you do everything in the name of your institution. And then that's opens you up for greed and power. Yeah? So it's a delicate balancing act. It really is. Well, you know, I have no ability to read other people's level of mind. But I do know that for myself, the best example of spiritual masters are the people who are really humble. Because I can look at myself, and my pride would love to, you know, do this. So I can see my pride is a problem. And I can see that as a defilement. And so for me, what's really good is a master who's very low-key and humble. Yeah? So I look at somebody like the Dalai Lama, you know, and the Tibetans are all, oh, this is Shinrezi and this is Buddha and everything. And His Holiness says, I'm just a simple monk, you know. And he's just, I mean, what is so remarkable about His Holiness is that he's so ordinary. You know, he doesn't go on high big trips. He doesn't do all sorts of extravagant this and that. He doesn't say he's this and that and the other thing. You know, he's just, he's so kind of ordinary. And when he's with a person, he's completely with that person. You know, I mean, you can feel his compassion for that person. And to me, that's what makes him so special. Yeah? Because humble people in our world are very rare. People who proclaim their qualities are numerous. Yeah. And I know for myself, you know, I need the example of somebody who's very humble. Of course, I cannot judge other people's level of realizations. Maybe they are enlightened. I don't know. But I can say the kind of teacher that appeals more to me, you know, and the kind of person that shows me an example that I know I have to become like. Okay? I'm glad you brought this up because it's something that I've thought about a lot too. Because especially when we go into Buddhism, all the lamas are telling us about the pure tradition and how wonderful Tibet was and da-da-da-da-da, you know. And so you finally think, I found the perfect group of people. You know, the Tibetans are so kind, they're so hospitable, they're so generous. And so kind of like finally after all this hassle in the West, I found some people who are just really nice and pure. And then you stay along a while. And then you stay and you stay. And you begin to realize Tibet is also samsara. You know, and that there's greed, ignorance, and hatred in the Tibetan community too. And then part of our West, I've been thinking about this a lot, you know, our Western bubble pops and we feel disillusioned. We feel let down. Because we had hoped beyond hope that we had finally met the perfect beings. And then they wind up to be ordinary people. And we just feel shattered inside. So I think there's a few things going on. I think one is that we have incredibly, kind of an unrealistic expectation of finding perfect people. Yeah? First of all, because any society where there's sentient beings, there's greed, ignorance, and hatred, and there's going to be injustice. Second of all, because our own mind is polluted and we project a lot of negative qualities onto other people. Yeah? So some of the faults that we're seeing might be due to our own projections. Because we hold on to democracy, you know? I mean, we bow down to democracy and money. So we think everybody in the world should. And then we judge other cultures by our own preconceptualized cultural values. So in that way we get disillusioned. So I think there's a few things going on here. First of all, our judgments based on our own preconceptions. And second of all, the fact that other cultures and people as a whole are sentient beings just like us. And so things aren't going to be perfect. Yeah? And to recognize that a religious system and the system of teachings can be very perfect, but all the people who practice them may not be. And many of them may be perfect, but because of our garbage mind, we project imperfection on them. And that many people who call themselves Buddhist may not actually practice Buddhism. They may not really integrate the teachings in their heart. So you come up with a social system like in Tibet. Yeah. I mean, this is one thing that the Westerners say a lot. You know, you talk so much about bodhicitta, and you're so, you know, the Tibetans are friendly and they're very kind people. But why were there serfs on the land and this whole distinction between rich and poor? You know, and why were there no social institutions to show your compassion? Why didn't everybody have good education? Why wasn't there public health system? Because that's just the way their culture evolved. They had a completely different cultural way. And in their minds, you practice compassion in this way. And they didn't see practicing compassion meaning equal education for all. Yeah, we do. So I think Buddhism coming to the West will take on a very different social feeling than it did for people who thought like they did in old Tibet. And I think that the Tibetan system is changing as a result of contact with the West and are asking these kinds of questions. Right. I mean, there are going to be differences there. On the other level, I think, you know, when there is excessive brutality and torture, no matter what social system you have, it's not right. Yeah. I think it's very possible, you know, I mean, that the people there experience the result of having to leave their country and, you know, it being occupied as a result of collective karma. Now, those people who experience that may not have all been Tibetans when they created the cause for that experience. You know, they may have been Chinese when they created the cause. Then later they were born as Tibetans and experienced that result, you know. But definitely karma is involved. Definitely. Yeah, please, you know, any thoughts like this that you want to bring up, I think please do, because I think this is the kind of thing, you know, that we as Westerners have to grapple with, that the Tibetans don't. And it can make a real block in our practice at times. So it's good we bring up these kinds of things and talk about them.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Back to eating meat, or is it a deep discussion?
Uh-huh.
More, I couldn't tell her, I couldn't tell whether you were saying this is purely an issue of it's useful or meaningful sometimes,
mm-hmm.
or whether there's a rightness or a wrongness. Mm. And those are different. They're different points in the practice. It's useful or not useful to eat meat.
Yeah, right. It's useful and not useful. And what makes it karmically, you know, beneficial or not beneficial is your motivation. So it's not, you know, anything cast in concrete. A lot of it depends on your motivation and your understanding. For example, you know, if you say, I'm a high tantric practitioner, when you're not, and use that as your justification for eating meat, that's not, that, you know, doesn't hold water, okay? If you go on a big trip, you know, I'm a vegetarian, everybody has to be a vegetarian, chances that pride could come up, yeah? So the basic thing is, you know, what's going on in the mind? What's the motivation? What's the understanding? Right. And also that different people are going to have different motivations approaching a certain situation. And according to your motivation, a certain physical action may be beneficial and it may be harmful, depending not so much on the action as on the mind that's doing it. Yeah? Other tantric practitioners creating negative karma by eating meat. The real tantric practitioners are not. Okay? Because at that level of the practice, you know, your whole intention of eating meat is because you need to keep those elements in your body strong so that you can do this very delicate meditation so that you can realize emptiness and become a Buddha. So your whole mind is directed towards enlightenment. It's not, oh, this meat tastes good and now I have an excuse to eat it. Okay? It's, you know, you're using it completely for your spiritual practice, and that's why. And then also the people at this level of the path, you know, they're saying mantras over the meat, they're making prayers for the animal, you know, may I be able to lead this animal to full enlightenment, you know. So it's very different from some guy who, you know, pulls up at McDonald's and eats 5 hamburgers. Of course, there he's eating more plastic than meat, but, you know. So a tantric practitioner isn't. You know, somebody who rationalizes is a completely different ballgame. Yeah? Okay. Yeah. Well, but now there's different ways of presenting the subject. Now, they say in terms of the killing precept, okay, if you killed it, if you asked somebody else to kill it, or if you know specifically it was killed specifically for you, then you have karma involved in the killing precept. Okay, and so for that reason, that meat should not be eaten. Now, the lamas, usually say just that, you know. Then the Westerners say, but what about meat that's already in the supermarket that's killed? And the lamas say, that's okay. And then the Westerners say, but by providing, you know, you're going in there and buying it, therefore they're killing it. And the lama said, yes, but you didn't ask that specific person to kill that for you. They had already done that, and you happened to come in the supermarket and get it. So the way I've put this together is, you know, that there is a difference in involving the karma of killing, of whether you have the direct influence of having this animal killed for you or doing it yourself or whatever. There's a difference between that and it already being killed.